the most original and creative talent in our business. Would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. We are here to talk about Orson Welles again. We have my friend Vincent, who is our specialist on Orson Welles. Over the next few weeks, I think he's really going to play an important part in that he knows some of the history of what Orson was doing at this time. And that comes into the commentary starting this week and for the next 3 weeks or so. And we have Catherine Foley Seeley joining us, another historian, also specializing in Jack Benny. That we, she's written books about him, and we do a lot of Jack Benny podcasts together. So let's hop right into this first Orson we have. And Vincent, what kind of struck you with this first one that we listened to?
Yeah. So for this first one, I mean, I think their listeners need to be situated in what's happening, because Welles sounds, and even he says it, he sounds like a bit of a crazy person. He's beginning, ramping up to show around the world his Broadway musical. At this point, they're not on Broadway yet. As he mentions, he's going to Boston. He's in Boston now, I believe. And he begins with sort of a very weird promotion, I will say, of Around the World. I think people will get confused what the heck he's talking about with this pigeon net, this butterfly net.
Yes.
And to understand that, I think, I'll explain Around the World, I think, a little bit more in the later, there's other episodes where he talks a lot about Around the World, but for now, what matters most is Welles's history and interest in magic and magic history in particular. Mm-hmm. Around the World, had a lot of magic components. Welles himself was an aspiring and magician and a card holding member of SAM, the Society of American Magicians. And he started really performing a lot of magic around this time. In 45, he did some USO work with the Mercury Wonder Show. Richard Himber, who's mentioned here as a band leader, is him and Orson are friends almost solely through magic. So it's sort of weird why this band leader would make this pigeon net. That's another thing Welles doesn't explain, but essentially Himber likes to make magical contraptions that Welles uses. Welles also at this time made a multimedia sort of magic trick for Himber, which was later used by David Copperfield. So if you remember David Copperfield's 1992 special where he communicates with Orson from the dead, Welles actually made that for Richard Himber. Oh. And David Copperfield changed. He dubbed over, where he says Dick, he makes it Dave, and, adds a sort of other mystical element that he's speaking to Dave Copperfield from the dead, given that Welles had been dead for 7 years. Wow. But what's important here is that, Welles's lifelong sort of interest in magic is culminating in Around the World. And so Around the World, it's a narrative, based on Jules Verne, but there's a bunch of magic tricks built into it. So sometimes there's like what was called the Indian rope trick, where this rope goes out of a basket and becomes, sort of strong, and somebody can climb it, even though it just appeared out of this basket. But there's one part in the show where Welles is the magician. He's in, he's masquerading as a Chinese, in quotes, magician, which is a common trope. Sort of a racist stereotype of the mystic Asian, which Welles sort of takes on, and he becomes Fu San, who does this magic trick. And this pigeon net is one of the things that he uses to make pigeons appear and disappear. And so Welles sort of makes it this really roundabout way of saying, like, look, I have this weird pigeon net, come see it in Around the World. But he gets really confusing about it. I will say one more thing to mention is that, I know Welles as a filmmaker first and foremost, and in this production, he has several films. He shot film sequences, five of them actually, and they're all missing. However, one of the things he does with these films is he makes them into magic tricks themselves. Welles was interested in multimedia magic and also avant-garde theater, which used film. And so at several points in Around the World, people appear to like go off stage and then appear in a film. At one point, he makes the stage appear as if it's film itself by making this like flashing strobe light like thing to seem like they're flickering and jumping, sort of appear like silent movies.
Yeah.
And at one other point, he makes it appear as if it's a live telecast by like making the stage seem like it's directly appearing what's on screen. So he's playing with media here as well as part of this these magic tricks. Anyway, that's a long way of saying Wells makes this weird promotion. Go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
At this point, it just to get my head straight as to where we're at, it has not premiered yet.
Yep.
It has. It has
no. It's in try. It's first week at tryouts.
Okay.
In Boston.
Okay. Yeah, but at this point he hasn't done the tryout yet, which is going to be next episode. But yeah, he's prepping for the tryout. Exactly.
And so as we get further into this in the next few weeks, I would assume there are reviews and things at the time that you guys maybe will share with us what people thought of the thing, because it sounds really interesting to me. I'd never thought that at this point in time, again, Orson always surprises me, that someone would do this multimedia sort of live with film, with everything going on.
Cole Porter.
Yeah. Right. I would, when you, just the way you describe it there, I'm going, oh, I would go see this in a heartbeat if somebody redid this. They'd have to redo the film pieces because you say all those are missing. But I would assume if somebody could recreate this, or maybe they already have, and maybe it's very popular. I don't know what, if it's ever been redone or not redone or whatever, but maybe you guys know more about that as well. But
yeah, it's never been redone. It's sort of a gargantuan show. I mean, it's been sort of restaged as readings a couple times. The Cole Porter rights make it a little complicated to restage as well. But I do actually, I did create an animation of one of the film sequences, which I'm happy to share in general, but no, it's never been redone. I'd love to. That was one of my big like inspirations. I wanted to redo this, but I think, I don't know. Maybe you just let it be history. That's what I decided.
I don't know. It got me excited. So you should do it, Vincent. So you would have an audience of one. Come on now.
But also to think that he's doing this, he was in like three different films that year. He's got the Mercury Theater on the radio every week, because when I searched for his commentaries, I also found he was on the air with the Mercury Theater. You know, the man never sleeps. No wonder Rita Hayworth up and leaves him. You know, I mean,
you can tell during these next 3 weeks, he actually is almost sleeping during the commentaries themselves.
These seem more
disjointed, and the writing of them's not quite up to par that we're used to. And of course his reading's not up to the par that we're used to, just because he's got too many things going at once.
He's insanely obsessed. He's very tired and depressed. But in terms of sort of Orson Welles studies, I bet you could say this is a great example through radio of probably what anybody who ever worked with him went through. Because I understand there was this same chaos up to the moment of War of the Worlds being broadcast. There was all this chaos on the Citizen Kane set.
This is more Orson as usual, actually. Yes. I think the other commentaries, the last several of them, have been really well polished, you know, and now we're starting to see. You know, that actually was a time where he was less busy than normal, I will say, up until Around the World. I mean, he's doing rehearsals and like Kathy's saying, he's doing other shows, but now he's suddenly trying to juggle too much, which is much more his forte. And we'll see that culminate with Around the World, you know, with the next radio broadcast in particular. But, you know, he worked fast and loose is probably more an apt way of describing it. I do say, though, that I think he pulls together this broadcast in a creative way that I thought was creative. I mean, he has this chaotic beginning where he's describing sort of Around the World in this roundabout way, but then he uses that as a foil to talk about all the political things, where he says, like, you know, my show is a musical comedy, but, you know, Congress is a musical comedy that's not funny, you know, and he compares them to a chorus and he says they're clowns. And so I thought it was a little creative. I was like, okay, you know, it wasn't like totally half dashed together. There's some thought here about tying it together.
You're right. He seems to, with these next three broadcasts, he's always got this way of finding, as you say, the metaphor, the theatrical thing, the connection. Because in the second half of the broadcast, turning what could be dry economic theory into getting his listeners going, this impacts you. OPA, you know, what's going to happen? And I'm just fascinated that he doesn't, in these broadcasts, doesn't say the word depression more, because he's hinting all about this, that if these greedy profit obsessed congressmen who want to stop the price controls, that they're going to cause, you know, all this, given that Wells is such a pro Rooseveltian, you know, that's that he didn't actually throw out the word, you're going to have another Great Depression more often, I thought was kind of interesting, because here he's trying to rally his troops, rally the progressives. I love when he's saying that, you know, people in Europe need food. It's going to wreck the veterans housing program. One of the, you know, predicting 50% inflation, in a way that's contemporary to today, because when we think of what's going on in these later stages of this pandemic, we've got a housing crisis like never before. You know, that we've had food shortages and hoarding and all these kind of things, and we don't have price controls, but especially
do you have
like
toilet paper? I'm out of toilet paper. I think there's too much hoarding going on of the toilet paper, and it's what you should do anytime there's an emergency. So, stock up on toilet paper. It makes complete sense. You can always eat it if you run out of food, I guess. I don't know.
So I mean, just the current things we're going to really had me at times very anxious, because I was really teleporting back, but also thinking about today's problems. So.
Oh, for sure. For sure. The whole thing with COVID comes up in this. All the stimulus that they're doing and they're passing, and they're saying, oh, that could cause inflation and all of this, which ties back to the things Orson's talking about. It's just always interesting to get these echoes through time and up to our present time. I mean, this is a great time for us to be looking at these shows 75 years later, in that it is an echo chamber that if we were looking at 5 years ago, I don't know if they would have the resonance that they do yet now. And so it's just interesting how time does echo itself and things. Well, I think what we'll do is end this one there. And I hope you enjoy this episode. It's a great episode. It's just fun to hear. This one seems he seems a little off. And it's going to get worse the next 2 or 3 weeks. He sort of starts to slowly fall apart. And so it's kind of fun to hear Orson sort of starting to lose it. So we will see you guys next time. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Orson Welles speaking. I flew into Boston early today on a rollicking tailwind, holding in my hand an immense butterfly net. Easter began somewhere up in the sky between New York and Massachusetts. According to my calculations, Connecticut, a busy and attractive state, rich in historical landmarks and natural resources, residents of Clare Luce and Chester Bowles. It's worth a visit or a broadcast any day. This morning, however, I bring from my journey across Connecticut little in the way of first-hand report, beyond a couple of updrafts and one tumultuous, timber-shivering air bump so violent that it almost broke the butterfly net. Of course, it isn't really a butterfly net, but that's what it looks like, and that's what it's been mostly called by people who've seen me carrying it in the street. To be quite truthful, it's a pigeon net. I use it to catch pigeons that weren't there before I caught them. See, it's very simple. It's a custom-built pigeon catcher, specially created for me by an orchestra leader named Richard Himber. It's about 6 feet long, very delicately contrived, so I had to give it the most loving care all the way from the LaGuardia airports. That's why I have so little to tell you about Connecticut, legal residence of Congresswoman Luce and price stabilizer Bowles. It's finally happened, you say. You who are still listening to these words, he's gone right out of his head. Well, you may be right, of course. Maybe I have gone berserk. This may be my last broadcast. And maybe this thing in front of me isn't a microphone at all. It's conceivable that I'm speaking solemnly into the handle of a mop and that this is not Station WCOP on St. James Avenue in Boston, Massachusetts, but rather some discreet loony bin tucked away in the Transvaal, a place of padded cells made to look like a broadcasting studio for unfortunate commentators who think they're Orson Welles. Or maybe I am Orson Welles, and I just think I'm a commentator. There's evidence in support of several theories is. It's entirely possible that radio itself is a private delusion of my own, something I dreamed up here in solitary. The notion that I'm telling, the little grill box in front of me, is audible as far as Mexico and Canada is, on the face of it, pretty far-fetched. And the idea that people in South Dakota and Washington, D.C. are spending any part of this beautiful Easter Sunday paying attention to what I'm saying here is surely madness. But I figure as long as I know that, there's hope for me. If I'm sane, or at least if I'm on the air, if radio is not a gaudy aspect of personal dementia, if the darn thing really exists, if this is what the man says it is, a national hookup and not a pipeline to the doctor's office in a booby hatch, if I am on the air, and most improbable of all, if you're listening to me, then I say to you with all the cool authority of the sane that I came to Boston this Easter morning, flying through the air and clinging like an overstuffed male witch to the handle of a magical pigeon net. That may be enough for you. You may believe that I've been flitting across New England with a long net in my hand, but it's imaginable that you count such behavior a trifle eccentric, and really, I can't blame you. I couldn't blame the folks at the field this morning who turned to stare when the pigeon catcher, the butterfly net, you call it whatever you want to, preceded me out of the plane. I didn't blame the cab driver for ogling, the traveling salesman in the Statler lobby for cracking wise, the elevator girl for giggling when I tripped over the handle. Man might bring to Boston on an Easter Sunday morning few objects less likely than a butterfly net. And the desk clerk at the hotel was so goggle-eyed at the spectacle, he gave me the wrong key. My deepest sympathy goes to the family who woke up to find me inadvertently catching pigeons in their bedroom. Nothing I can say seems quite adequate. But the explanation is as aggravatingly simple as a card trick, and here it is. Cole Porter and I have written a musical comedy from Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days. Pretty much at the last minute, a magician was written into the script, and lacking time to teach the technical side of the illusions we're using to the unmagical-minded actor who'll play the part on Broadway if we ever get there, I prevailed upon myself to saw the lady in half, to float her through space and produce a couple of goldfish bowls and a brace of pigeons from thin air. So that's how I came to Boston with a butterfly net, and that's where we came in. I only wish the news from Washington could be explained so easily. After all the facts are in, my pigeon catcher makes a kind of sense of its own. But the bill for extending price control, which doesn't extend price control, makes no sense. 4 days ago, after 12 hours of quiet hysteria, Congress gave price control another 9 months to live and tied a rosary of lead sinkers called amendments to its neck, tossed it out, and turned to other things. The lawmakers who tacked on these new amendments might just as well have tacked green whiskers on their chins, dressed up in cap and bells, or dominoes made out of the congressional record and run gibbering down Pennsylvania Avenue. Those lawmakers aren't appearing in a musical comedy, but they might just as well be. In the symbolic toga of the high elective office, they've made exactly no sense at all. The congressman who've just given the cost of living over to chaos might do better in baggy pants and with a touch of red on the nose. We'd know we were supposed to laugh. If we didn't like their jokes, we could walk out on them. But you can't walk out on inflation. The men behind those amendments aren't magicians. They've sawed our best, most wholesome hope for reconversion in half and thrown away the book of instructions. They don't know how to put the lady together again. They don't seem to want to. The stage is covered with blood, and they're out in front of the curtain taking bows. It's about as magical as a butcher shop. And as funny. What next? Well, if the House bill becomes a law, there'll be no more control on most farm products, the majority of basic industrial products, metals, textiles, rubber, leather, chemicals, coke, stone, and glass. If that House bill gets to be a law, it blows the ceilings off cars, electric iceboxes, and other things like that, things you want, things you won't be able to afford unless the price is anchored to the same planet as your income. But if your bread butter is just one item, but it's going to cost you twice what it does now, if that House bill gets to be a law, there'll be an immediate 50% increase in meat, a 50% increase in cheese, a 40% increase in canned foods. Get out a pencil and figure out your new household budget. If you have to be a magician, you be able to do that. Your household budget brings us to your house. If you pay rent for your house and that bill gets to be a law, you're in for trouble. Better figure now on paying a lot more, no matter what the men behind the amendments may be claiming to the contrary. If that bill gets to be a law, OPA is going to find rent control impossible. OPA cannot expect the landlords to sit still and behave. with living costs on a drunken balloon ride and the whole nation abandoned to an economic binge. Controls will have to go off steel if that bill with its amendments gets to be a law, and don't expect reasonable ceilings on refrigerators or automobiles or gas stoves or any other high-quantity steel items. The lid would blow off half to three-quarters of all major manufactured items, and what does that mean? Right away, it means wrecking the program for housing vets. Europe is starving. There isn't much chance for peace in this weary old world of ours if we don't send food, plenty of it, and right away to our neighbors, to their little hollow-eyed, spindly-legged children. This congressional extension of price control with all the new jokers on it takes the food away from those starving kids just as we're ready to set it down in front of them. If that House bill gets to be a law, food costs will take a quick rise, 35 to 40%, and that raises the percentage on the chances of war. Kids are going to have to go hungry. And there's that new suit of yours. Don't count on it. The cotton textile amendment on that House bill will take care of your new suit. Start saving for it now. Over here, we have the Crawford Amendment, eliminating cost absorption, the Crawford Amendment. Among other things, this little gimmick would add approximately $500 million to the consumer price of automobiles. Then there's the Profit Guarantee Amendment. Sounds pretty good in a press release by the NAM. Guarantees a profit on every item, which sounds just fine administratively. However, this amendment is impossible for OPA or any conceivable government agency. It would start a cycle of increases up and down the line. My best information is that 85% of the manufacturers don't have actual cost accounting figures available. The bill we've been talking about passed in the House of Representatives by a coalition of Southern Democrats interested in cotton and cotton speculation, and of Northern Republicans interested in short-term profits at the expense of the national economy. With its amendments, it means just this. No price control. Now, OPA has made and is making a lot of mistakes. It's occasionally restrictive and usually inconvenient, but no price control. That's something else again. Try adding that one up in terms of butter and the life expectancy of a baby. No price control. Put iceboxes and automobiles and world peace into your computations. The shadow of coming events is already dark on the land. The stock market has risen to the highest peak in 15 years. Speculation has increased. Goods are being hoarded. Warehouses are choked with short items. Consumers are starting to grab all the commodities they can. All this in the expectation of a boom inflationary period. And, of course, if the House bill gets to be a law, labor's going to come out for wage increases and more of them. Since VJ Day, remember, raises to labor have been based on a stable economy. Without that stability, we'll be strike-bound. And, of course, the white-collar groups, the unorganized little fellow, will be hurt the most of all. Here it is, Easter Sunday, one of the gayest mornings of a year. The ladies are out with their fancy bonnets. A lot of the men folks look slightly uncomfortable in their tight new shoes. The kids are happy with their bunnies and their candy eggs. Main Street feels optimistic, and in Wall Street, too. They have a feeling of optimism. As a matter of fact, they're feeling no pain. Many a swank corner hotel suite gentleman in Washington, now abed, are beginning to stir from a whiskey-clouded sleep. They have hangovers, but they're as happy as the kids with the candy eggs on the lawn. From their bosses and the financial marts, the telegrams have come in. Well done. In many Washington circles, there's rejoicing in death this Easter morning. The lobbyists have won again. The OPA is dead, and the hand that held the dagger and plunged it into the heart of the American consumer carries the label NAM. Experts in the government frankly forecast a 50% inflation by October 1st. The lobbyists from the far ends of the South, united with Wall Street, are losing no time doing the same job in the Senate that they did in the House. And what is Mr. Truman? What is Mr. Truman doing all the while? He and his fumbling reconversion director, Mr. Snyder, are taking a ride on the Potomac. Right now, there are more than 1,000 lobbyists working full-time against the OPA. It reminds you of the drive the power and utility lobbyists used to put on. Unless the people rise up in their righteous wrath and smack down these lobbyists, inflation will be well on the road to destroying this country of ours. And believe me, friends, there's trouble on another front, the food front. It's sagging badly. The administration has adopted a very unrealistic program here. I'd like to give a hand now to Fiorella LaGuardia for the wonderful way in which he's moved on the food crisis. Butch isn't fooling, and he knows his stuff. Nobody's fooling Butch either. He'll negotiate with the devil to get food, and he's doing just that. This food business is just another sample, of course, of how the lack of thinking and planning in the administration has brought us stumbling to our knees. And in the midst of a mess we could have avoided, the whole thing was obvious a year ago. But the administration closed its eyes, hoped it'd all pass away. What does Mr. Truman need? He needs some real thinkers around him. He needs more professors and less poker players. Otherwise, all his fine words about following the Roosevelt plan will be as empty in practice as they often look in print. The inside story can be spelled out in a couple of words. This is an election year. The administration is afraid to cut down on food with the campaign coming up, so the boys in the back room have decided to muddle through. The Combined Food Board, composed of the United States and Great Britain, controls the bulk of world food supply. But only nations which see eye to eye with American and British policies get what they need. America and Britain have brought the entire Argentine and Uruguayan linseed oil supply. This oil, approximately 150,000 tons of it, will go to make paint for ourselves and the British. If you want a reason why the Russians sent an economic mission to Peron's Buenos Aires, I don't think you need to look any further than that. Maybe we should call it the Combined Food Fraud. Now my time for broadcasting's run out. I'm off to the theater to watch them hang the scenery for our Friday opening, off to the crazy world of dress rehearsals, light cues and dance drills. And it does seem a long way from common sense reality, but I can't help insisting as I pick up my magical pigeon-catching butterfly net and start away that common sense reality is not the purpose of a musical comedy. It is the purpose of a Congress. The Southern Democrat, Republican, reactionary mixed chorus will now sing in close harmony their theme song. We got ours, who cares about you? Really isn't much of a number, but if we let them stay on with it, you can lay odds they'll stop the show. Well, thanks for listening. Please let me come to call again next Sunday. Till then, I remain as always, obediently yours.
The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations have brought you the personal and individual news commentary of Orson Welles. This program came to you from Boston.
Next Sunday, daylight saving time goes into effect in some eastern and western communities. But this won't change your listening habits to Orson Welles. Your station has made special arrangements to broadcast this program at exactly the same time as you heard it today. Remember, Orson Welles on this station is heard at the same time each week. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.